it's the gate that's the problem.
I'd say so.
Would it work?
It just might.
My office, said Peter. 2 hours.
Open the door. The officer keyed the lock. Peter stepped inside. Alicia was sitting on the floor of the cell. Her arms and legs were shackled in front. A third chain connected her hands to a heavy iron ring in the wall. Thick fabric had been used to cover the window, muting the light.
About time, she said drolly. I was beginning to think you'd forgotten me.
I'll knock when I'm done, Peter told the guard. He left them alone. Peter sat on the cot facing Alicia. A silent moment, the two regarding each other across a distance that felt far vaster than it was.
How are you feeling? He asked.
Oh, you know.
A shrug, dismissive. Beats a bullet to the brain.
You had me going for a second there.
I was angry. I still am.
Yeah, I sensed that.
Her eyes took slow measure of his face.
Now that I have a chance to really look at you, I've got to say, you're holding up nicely. That snow on the roof suits you.
He smiled, just a little. And you look the same. She glanced around the tiny box of a room.
And you're really running the show here? President and all that?
That seems to be the case.
Like it?
The last couple of days haven't been so hot. These wry exchanges, like a dance to a song that only the two of them could hear.
He couldn't help himself. He'd missed them.
You've put me in a bind, Lish. That was a pretty big splash you made last night.
My timing wasn't the best.
As far as this government is concerned, you're a traitor. She looked up.
And what does Peter Jackson think? You've been gone a long time. Amy seems to believe you're on our side.
But she's not the one calling the shots.
I am on your side, Peter. But that doesn't change the situation. In the end, you're going to have to give her up. You can't beat him.
See, this is where I have a problem. I've never heard you talk that way. Not about anything.
This is different. Fanning is different. He's been controlling everything from the start. The only reason we were able to kill the 12 was because he let us. We're all pieces on a board to him.
So why would you trust him now?
Maybe I'm not being clear. I don't. He comforted you. He took care of you. Am I remembering this correctly?
He did, Peter. But that's not the same thing.
You're gonna have to do better than that.
Why? So you'll believe me? The way I see it, you don't have a choice.
Who am I talking to here? You or Fanning?
Her eyes sharpened with anger. His words had hit the mark.
I took an oath, Peter. Same as you, same as Apgar, same as every man on that wall last night. I stayed with Fanning because I believed he'd leave Kerrville alone. Yes, he was good to me. I never said he wasn't. Believe it or not, I actually feel sorry for the guy, until I remember what he is.
And what's that?
The enemy.
Was she lying? For the moment, it didn't matter. That she wanted him to believe her was leverage he could use.
Tell me what we're up against. How many Draks are out there?
I think what you saw last night.
The rest of Fanning's forces are in New York, in other words. He's holding them in reserve.
Alicia nodded.
I wasn't followed, if that's what you mean. The rest are in tunnels under the city.
And you don't know what he wants with Amy?
If I knew, I'd tell you. Trying to understand Fanning is a fool's errand. He's a complicated man, Peter. I was with him for 20 years, and I never figured him out completely. Mostly, he just seems sad. He doesn't like what he is, but he sees a kind of justice in it. Or at least he wants to. Peter frowned.
I'm not following.
Alicia took a moment to form her thoughts. In the station, there's a clock. Long ago, Fanning was supposed to meet a woman there.
She looked up.
It's a long story. I can give you all of it, but it'd take hours.
Give me the short version.
The woman's name was Liz. She was Jonas Lear's wife.
Peter was caught short.
Yeah, it surprised me, too. They all knew each other. Fanning loved her since they were young. When she married Lear, he pretty much gave up on the whole thing. But not really. Then she got sick. She was dying. Some kind of cancer. Turns out, she loved him too. She had all along. She and Fanning were going to run away, spend her last days together. You should hear him tell the story, Peter. It'd just about rip your heart out. The clock was where they were going to meet. But Liz never showed. She died on the way. But Fanning didn't know that. He thought she'd changed her mind. That night, he got drunk in a bar and went home with a woman. She was a stranger, nobody he knew. He killed her.
So he's a murderer, in other words.
Alicia made an expression of demurral. Well, it was sort of an accident, the way he tells it. He was half out of his mind. He thought his life was basically over. She pulled a knife on him. They struggled. She fell on it.
Putting him on death row. Like the 12.
No. He got away with it. He actually felt awful about the whole thing. He was plenty mixed up. But he was no hardened killer. At least not yet. It was later that he went to South America with Lear, which is where the virus comes from. Lear had been looking for it for years. He thought he could use it to save his wife, though that was a moot point by then. Fanning describes the guy as totally obsessed.
Was that how Fanning caught the virus?
Alicia nodded. As far as I can tell from Fanning's story, it happened by chance, though in his head, Lear was responsible. After Fanning got infected, Lear brought him back to Colorado. He was still hoping to use the virus as a kind of cure-all. But the military got involved. They wanted to use it as a weapon, make some kind of super soldier out of it. That was when they brought in the 12 inmates. Peter thought for a moment. Then, his thoughts crystallizing. What about Amy? Why did the army make her? They didn't. That was Lear. He used a different virus, not descended from the one Fanning carried. That's why she's not the same as the others. That, plus she was so young. I think he maybe knew that the whole thing had gone bad and was trying to make it right. It's a strange way of doing it. Like I said, Fanning is pretty much of the opinion that the man was off his rocker. Either way, in Fanning's mind, Amy is the fish that got away. Killing the 12 was a test. Not of us, since we never stood a chance against them. Fanning was testing her. I don't know why I didn't think of it at the time. His positioning them all in one place like that. He was never particularly fond of them, to put it mildly. A bunch of psychotics is how he puts it. And he's not?
Alicia shrugged.
Depends on your definition. If you mean he doesn't know right from wrong, I'd have to say no. He's pretty well versed on the subject, actually. Which is the strangest thing about him. The part I could never really get. Your ordinary drac doesn't care one way or another. It's just an eating machine. Fanning thinks about everything. Maybe Michael could keep up with him, but I never could.
Talking to him was like being dragged by a horse. So why test her? What was he trying to find out? Alicia glanced away, then said, I think he wanted to know if she really was different from the rest of them. I don't think he wants to kill her. That'd be too obvious. If I had to guess, I'd say it all comes down to his feelings about Lear. Fanning hated the guy, really hated, and not just because of what Lear did to him. It goes deeper than that. Lear made Amy as a way to set things straight. Maybe Fanning just can't sit with that. Like I said, he mostly seems miserable. He sits in that station staring at the clock as if time stopped for him when Liz didn't show. Peter waited for more, but Alicia seemed to end there. Last night, you called him a man. She nodded. At least that's how he looks, though there are a few differences. He's sensitive to light, much more than I am. He never sleeps, or almost never. Likes his dinner warm. And, she used her thumb and forefinger to indicate her incisors. He's got these. Peter frowned. Fangs? She nodded. Just these two. Was he always that way? Actually, no. At the start, he was exactly like the rest of them. But something happened. An accident. He fell into a flooded quarry. This was early on, just a few days after he broke out of the Noah lab. None of us can swim. Fanning went straight to the bottom. When he woke up, he was lying on the shore, looking like he does now. She paused, eyes narrowing on his face, as if struck by a sudden thought. Is that what happened to Amy? Something like that. But you're not going to tell me. Peter left it there. Could water change back his many? Fanning says no. Just him. Peter rose from the cot. A wave of lightheadedness passed through him. He really needed to lie down, even for just a few minutes. But it seemed important not to show her how exhausted he was. An old habit, from the days when the two of them had stood the watch together, each always trying to best the other. I can do this. Can you? Sorry about those chains. Alicia lifted her wrists, examining them with a neutral expression, as if they were not her hands, but someone else's. She shrugged and let them fall to her lap again. Forget it. It's not like I'm making this easy for you. Do you need anything? Food? Water? My diet is a little peculiar these days. Peter understood. I'll see what I can do. A silent moment, each of them acknowledging the awkwardness of the situation. I know you don't want to believe me, Alicia said. Hell, I wouldn't. But I'm telling you the truth. Peter said nothing. We were friends, Peter. All those years, you were the one person I could always rely on. We stood for each other. Yes, we did. Just tell me, that still counts for something. As he looked at her, his mind went back to the night when they had said goodbye to each other at the Colorado Garrison, so many years ago. The night before he had ridden up the mountain with Amy. How young they'd been. Standing outside the soldiers' barracks, the cold wind lancing through them. He had loved Alicia fiercely, as he had never loved anyone in his life. Not his parents, or auntie, or even his brother Theo. No one. It was not the love of a man for a woman, or a brother for a sister, but something leaner, paired to its essence, a binding subatomic energy that had no words to name it. Peter could no longer recall what they'd said to one another. Only the impression remained, like footprints in snow. It was one of those moments when it had still seemed possible to understand life and what was meant by living one. He had been young enough to still believe that such a thing was possible. And the recollection carried a striking vividness of emotion, as if 3 decades had not passed since that cold and distant hour in which he had stood in the sheltering light of Alicia's courage. But then he blinked the memory away. His mind returned to the present, and what remained was only a great weight of sadness at the center of his chest. 200,000 souls gone, and Alicia at the center of it all. "Yes," he said, "it counts. But I'm afraid it doesn't change a thing." He gave 3 hard bangs on the door. Tumblers turned, and the guard appeared. "Don't be dumb, Peter. Fanning's everything I say he is. I don't know what you're planning, but don't." "Thank you," he said to the guard. "I'm finished here." The chain attaching Alicia to the wall rattled as she yanked on it. "Listen to me, goddammit. It's no good fighting him." But these words barely reached his ears. Peter was already striding down the hall. 61. "And now, my Alicia, you reside among them. How do I know this? I know it as I know everything. I am a million minds, a million histories, a million roving pairs of eyes. I am everywhere, my Alicia, watching you. I have watched you since the beginning, taking measure and stock. Would it be too much to say that I felt your arrival on the day you were born into this world? A wet, squealing nugget, the hot blood of protest already pouring through your veins? Impossible, of course. Yet it seems so. Such is the bewitching way of Providence. All seems ordained, all known, both in forward and reverse. What an entrance you made! With what bold declaration, what showmanship, what authoritative poise did you step into the city's lights and stake your claim? How could the occupants of the besieged metropolis fail to swoon under your spell, enchanted by the drama of your arrival? I am Alicia Donadio, captain of the expeditionary. Forgive, Alicia, these windy flights. My mood is grandiose. Not since the great Achilles stood without the battlements of mighty Troy has our pocket of creation seen the likes of you. Within those walls, no doubt, a great parliament commences. Debates, edicts, threats, and counter-threats. The customary swordplay of a city under siege. Do we fight? Do we run? Earnest and admirable, yet, and you must pardon the analogy, these discussions are to the outcome what splashing is to drowning. They only make the whole thing go faster. In your absence, Alicia, I have, so to speak, taken a page from your book. Night after night, the dark beckons me. My feet cast me wandering anew into the streets of mighty Gotham. Summer has come at last upon this isle of exile. In the branches the songbirds twitter. The trees and flowers clutter the breeze with their airborne sexual excreta. Newborn creatures of every ilk undertake their first uncertain adventures in the grass. Last night, recalling your concerns for my strength, I devoured a litter of 6 young bunnies in your honor.
What is this new restlessness inside me? Adrift among Manhattan's maze of glass and steel and stone. I feel closer to you, yes, but something else as well. A sense of the past so glowingly intense it is practically hallucinatory. It was in summer, after all, when I traveled to New York for my friend Lucchesi's funeral, when this city first laid its hand of love upon me. I close my eyes, and there I am. With her, my Liz, the woman and the place indelible, one and the same. The appointed hour at the clock. And then our exit into the moist human heat of the season's early rush. The abrupt encapsulation of the taxi, with its cracked vinyl bench and feeling of a million prior occupants. The parade of heaving humanity clogging the streets and sidewalks. The impatiently perfunctory honking of horns and the cat-like mating shrieks of sirens. The majestic towers of Midtown, glazed and shining with the hour's exhausted light. My bright, almost painful awareness of everything. A rush of undifferentiated data to my brain. All of it permanently inseparable from the beloved and eternal her. Her shining, sun-blessed shoulders. The faint, womanly aroma of her perspiration in the sealed space of the taxi. Her wan, expressive face, with its touch of mortality. And her myopic gaze, always peering deeper into things. The perfection of her hand in my own as we wandered the dark streets together. Alone, among millions. It has been said that in ancient times there was only one gender. In that blissful state, humankind existed until, as punishment, the gods divided each of us in two, a cruel mitosis that sent each half forever spinning across the earth in search of its mate, so that it could be whole again. That was how her hand felt in my own, Alicia, as if, of all men upon the earth, I had found that one. Did she kiss me that night as I was sleeping? Was it a dream? Is there a difference? That is my New York, as it was once so many's. The kiss one dreams of. All lost, all gone, as is the city of your love, Alicia, the city of your rose. Call Fanning, my friend Lucchesi wrote. Call Fanning to tell him that love is all there is, and love is pain. And love is taken away. How many hours did he hang there? How many days and nights did my mother linger, floating in a sea of agony? And where was I? What fools we are. What fools we mortals be. Thus does the hour of reckoning approach. Unto God I issue my just complaint. 'Twas he who cruelly dangled love before our eyes, like a brightly colored toy above a baby's crib. From nothing he made this world of woe. To nothing it shall return. I know she's here, you said. I can hear it. In your voice, and I in yours, my Alicia, I in yours.
62. Two soldiers, rifles dangling, stood at the end of the walkway. As Peter approached, they stiffened, popping quick salutes. All quiet here? Peter asked. Dr. Wilson went in a while ago. Anyone else? He wondered if Gunner had visited, or maybe Greer. Not since we came on duty. The door opened as he mounted the porch. Sarah, carrying her small leather satchel of instruments. Their eyes met in a way that Peter understood. He embraced her and backed away. I don't know what to say, Peter began. Her hair was damp and pressed to her forehead, her eyes swollen and bloodshot. We all loved her. Thank you, Peter. Her words were flat, without emotion. Is it true about Alicia? He nodded. What are you going to do with her? I don't know at this point. She's in the stockade. Sarah didn't say anything. She didn't have to. Her face said it all. We trusted her. Now look. How's Amy? Peter asked. Sarah heaved a sigh. You can see for yourself. I'm a little out of my depth here, but as far as I can tell, she's fine. Fine as in human. A little malnourished, and she's very weak. But the fever's gone. If you brought her in here and didn't tell me who she was, I'd say she was a perfectly healthy woman in her mid-twenties who'd just come off a bad bout of the flu. Somebody please explain this to me. As compactly as he could, Peter related the story. The Bergensfjord, Greer's vision, Amy's transformation. What are you going to do? Sarah said. I'm working on it. Sarah seemed dazed. The information had begun to sink in. I guess maybe I owe Michael an apology. Funny to think about that at a time like this. There's a meeting in my office at 0730. I need you there. Why me? There were lots of reasons. He went with the simplest. Because you've been part of this from the beginning. And now part of the end, Sarah said grimly. Let's hope not. She fell silent, then said, A woman came into the hospital yesterday in labor. Early stages. We might have just sent her home. But she and her husband were there when the horn went off. Along about 3 a.m., she decides to have her baby. A baby. In the middle of all this. Sarah looked at Peter squarely. Know what I wanted to tell her? He shook his head. Don't. The bedroom door was ajar. Peter paused at the threshold. The drapes were shut, bathing the room in a thin yellowish light. Amy was turned on her side, eyes closed, face relaxed, one arm tucked beneath the pillow. He was about to retreat when her eyes fluttered open. Hey. Her voice was very soft. It's okay, go back to sleep. I just wanted to check on you. No, stay. She cast her eyes groggily around the room. What time is it? I'm not sure. Early. Sarah was here. I know, I saw her leave. How are you feeling? She frowned pensively. I don't know. Then, eyes widening as if the idea surprised her. Hungry? Such an ordinary want. Peter nodded. I'll see what I can do. In the kitchen, he lit the kerosene stove. He hadn't used it in months, then went outside to tell the soldiers what he needed. While he waited, he washed up. By the time they returned, carrying a small basket, the fire was ready to go. Buttermilk, eggs, a potato, a loaf of dense, dark bread, and mixed berry jam in a jar sealed with wax. He set to work, happy to have this small chore to take his mind from other things. In a cast-iron pan, he fried the potatoes and then the eggs. The bread he cut into thick slices and smeared with jam. How long since he'd cooked a meal for another person? Probably for Caleb as a boy. Years ago. He arranged Amy's breakfast on a tray, added a glass of buttermilk, and carried it all to the bedroom. He'd wondered if she'd fall asleep again in his absence. Instead, he found her alert and sitting up. She had pulled the drapes aside. Evidently, the light had ceased to trouble her. A smile blossomed at the sight of him, standing in the doorway like a waiter with his tray.
"Wow," she said.
Peter placed the tray on her lap. "I'm not much of a cook." Amy was staring at the food as if she were a prisoner released from years in jail.
"I don't even know where to start. The potatoes? The bread?"
She smiled decisively.
"Now, the milk."
She drained the glass and set to work on the rest, jabbing the food with her fork like a field hand. Peter dragged a chair to the bedside.
"Maybe you should slow down."
She glanced up, speaking around a mouthful of eggs.
"Aren't you going to eat?"
He was famished, but enjoyed watching her.
"I'll get something later."
Peter went to the kitchen to refill her glass. By the time he returned, her plate was empty. He handed her the buttermilk and watched her polish it off. A healthy color had flowed back into her cheeks.
"Come sit by me," she said.
Peter cleared her tray and perched on the edge of the bed. Amy slipped her hand into his.
"I've missed you," she said.
It felt so unreal to be sitting here talking to her.
"I'm sorry I got old."
"Oh, I think I've got you beat there." He almost laughed. There was so much he wanted to say, to tell her. She looked just as she did in his dreams. The short hair was the only difference. Her eyes, the warmth of her smile, the sound of her voice, all were the same.
"What was it like in the ship?"
She dropped her face. Her thumb moved gently over the top of his hand.
"Lonely. Strange. But Lucius took care of me."
She looked at him again.
"I'm sorry, Peter. You couldn't know."
"Why?"
"Because I wanted you to live your life. To be happy. I heard Caleb call you Dad. I'm glad. For both of you."
"He's married, you know. His wife is Pim."
"Pim,"
Amy repeated, and smiled. "They have a son, too. They named him Theo." She gently squeezed his hand.
"So there's a life, right there. What else made you happy? I want to know."
"You did," he thought.
"You made me happy. I've been with you every night since you were gone. I've lived a whole life with you, Amy."
But he could not find the words to say this.
"That night in Iowa," he began. "That was real, wasn't it?" "I'm not sure I even know what real is anymore.
I mean, it happened. It wasn't a dream." Amy nodded.
"Yes. Why did you come to me?"
Amy's eyes darted away, as if the memory pained her.
"I'm not sure I know." "I was confused. The change had happened so fast. Probably I shouldn't have done it. I was so ashamed of what I was."
"Why would you think that?"
"I was a monster, Peter."
"Not to me." Their eyes met and held. Her hand was warm, though not with fever. It was the warmth of life. A thousand times he'd held it. And yet this was also the first.
"Is Alicia all right?"
Amy asked. "Oh, she's tougher than that. What do you want me to do with her?"
"I don't think that's my decision."
"It's not. But I still need to know what you think."
"This isn't simple for her. She's been with him a long time. I think there's a lot she's not telling us.
Like what? Amy thought for a moment, then shook her head.
I can't tell. She's very sad. But it's like there's a locked box inside her. I can't get past it.
Their eyes met again.
She needs you to trust her, Peter.
I'm one side of her. Fanning's the other. Between us, there's you. It's you she's really here to see. She needs to know who she is. Not just who she is. What she is.
So what is she?
What she always was. Part of this. Part of us. You're her family, Peter. You have been from the start. She needs to know that you still are.
Peter felt the truth of her words. But knowing something was not the same thing as believing it.
That was the hell of it, he thought.
You're not going with her, he said. I can't allow it.
You may not have a choice about that. Alicia's right. The city can't stand indefinitely. Sooner or later, I'll have to face him.
I don't care. I lost you once. I'm not doing it again.
Footsteps in the hall. Peter turned as Caleb appeared in the doorway, Pim behind him. For a moment, Peter's son appeared dumbstruck. A warm light switched on in his eyes.
It's really you, he said.
Amy smiled.
Caleb, I believe I would like to hug you.
Peter stepped back. Amy rose on her elbows as Caleb leaned over the bed and the two embraced. When at last they parted, they still held one another by the elbows, each beaming into the other's happy face. Peter understood what he was seeing. The deep bond that Amy and his son shared, forged in the days before Iowa, when Amy had looked after him in the orphanage.
You look so grown up,
Caleb said, laughing. Amy laughed, too.
So do you.
Caleb turned to his wife, speaking and signing simultaneously.
Amy, this is Pim, my wife. Pim, Amy. How do you do, Pim?
Amy signed.
Very well, thank you,
Pim replied. Amy's hands were moving with expert speed.
It's a beautiful name. You're just as I pictured you. You too.
Caleb stared at the two women. Only then did it occur to Peter that the exchange he had just witnessed was technically impossible.
Amy, Caleb said, how did you do that?
She frowned at her splayed fingers.
Now I don't think I know. I suppose the sisters must have taught me.
None of them can sign. She dropped her hands to her lap and looked up.
Well, somebody must have. How else could I have done it?
More footsteps. An atmosphere of official briskness accompanied Apgar into the bedroom. Mr. President, I'm sorry for the interruption, but I thought I might find you here. His chin lifted toward the bed. Pardon me, ma'am. How are you feeling? Amy was sitting up now, hands folded in her lap.
Much better, thank you, General.
He narrowed his attention on Caleb. Lieutenant, aren't you supposed to be in your rack?
I wasn't tired, sir.
That wasn't what I asked. And don't look at your father. He's not interested. Caleb took Amy's hand and gave it a final squeeze.
Get better, okay?
Now, Mr. Jackson. Caleb exchanged a hasty, unreadable sign with Pim and exited the room. If you're done here, Apgar said, it's time. People will be waiting. Peter turned to Amy.
I better go.
Amy appeared not to have heard him. Her eyes were fixed on Pim's. The seconds stretched as the two women regarded each other with a crackling intensity, as if engaged in a private, inaudible conversation.
Amy?
She startled, breaking the circuit. It seemed to take her a moment to assemble her sense of her surroundings. Then she said, very calmly,
Of course.
And you'll be all right here? Peter said. Another smile, but not the same. more of reassurance than something genuine. There was something hollow about it, even forced.
Perfectly.
63. Mirrors, Chase repeated. Around the conference table, clockwise from Peter's left, sat the players, Peter's war cabinet, Apgar, Henneman, Sarah, Michael, Greer. It doesn't have to be a mirror specifically. Anything reflective will work, just as long as they can see themselves. Chase took a long breath and folded his hands on the table. This is the craziest thing I've ever heard. It's not crazy at all. 30 years ago, in Las Vegas, Lish and I were running from a pod of three and got cornered in a kitchen. We were out of ammunition, pretty much defenseless. A bunch of pots and pans were hanging from the ceiling. I grabbed one to use as a club, but when I held it out at the first viral, it stopped the bastard cold, like it was hypnotized. And this was just a copper pot. Michael, back me up here. He's right. I've seen it too. Apgar asked Michael, so what does it do to them? Why does it slow them down? Hard to say. My guess would be some kind of residual memory. Meaning what? Meaning they don't like what they see, because it doesn't conform to some other aspect of their self-image. He turned toward Peter. Do you remember the viral you fought in Tifty's cage? Peter nodded. After you killed her, you said something to Tifty. Her name was Emily. Her last memory was kissing a boy. How did you know that? It was a long time ago, Michael. I can't really explain it. She was looking at me, and it just happened. Not just looking. She was staring. You both were. People don't look a viral in the eye when it's about to rip them in half. The natural impulse is to look away. You didn't. And just like the mirror, it stopped her flat. Michael paused, then said, with deeper certainty, the more I think about this, the more sense it makes. It explains a lot of things. When a person gets taken up, their first impulse is to go home. Dying people feel the same way. Sarah, am I right about that? She nodded. It's true. Sometimes it's even the last thing people say. I want to go home. I can't tell you how often I've heard it. So a viral is a person infected with a virus. Strong, super aggressive. But somewhere deep down, they remember who they were. During the transitional phase, let's say, that memory gets buried. But it doesn't go away. Not completely. It's just a kernel, but it's there. Eyes are reflective, just like mirrors. When they see themselves, the memory rises to the surface, and it confuses them. That's what stops them. A sort of nostalgia. It's the pain of remembering their human lives and seeing what they've become. That's quite a theory, Henneman said. Michael shrugged. Maybe. Maybe I'm just talking out of my exhaust pipe, and it wouldn't be the first time. But let me ask you something, Colonel. How old are you? I'm sorry? 60? 63? He scowled a little. I'm 58, thank you. My mistake. Ever look in a mirror? I try to avoid it. Precisely my point. In your mind, you're the same person you always were. Hell, between my ears, I'm still just a 17-year-old kid. But the reality is different, and it's depressing to look at. I don't see any 20-year-olds around this table, so I'm guessing I'm not alone. Peter turned toward his chief of staff. Ford, what do we have that reflects? We'd need to cover the whole gate, and it's best if we have at least 100 yards on either side, more if we can do it. He thought for a moment. Galvanized roofing metal could work, I suppose. It's pretty shiny. How much do we have? A lot of that stuff has moved out to the townships, but we should have enough. We can strip some houses if we come up short. Get engineering on it. We also need to reinforce that gate. Tell them to weld the damn thing shut if they have to. The portal, too. Chase frowned. How will people get out? Out is not the issue right now. For the time being, they won't. Mr. President, if I may, Henneman cut in. Assuming this all works, a big if, in my opinion, we still have a couple hundred thousand virals running loose out there. We can't stay inside the walls forever.
I hate to contradict you, Colonel, but that's exactly what we did in California. First Colony stood for almost a century with a fraction of the resources. We're down to just a few thousand people, a sustainable population if we manage it right. Within these walls, we have enough arable land for planting and livestock. The river gives us a good continuous source for drinking water and irrigation. With some modification, we can still run oil up from Freeport in smaller loads, and the refinery itself is defensible. With careful rationing, using all of our refined petroleum for the lights, we should be fine for a very long time.
And weaponry? Tifty's bunker can supply us for a while, and probably we can remanufacture more, at least to last for a few more years. After that, we use crossbows, longbows, and incendiaries. We made it work at First Colony. We'll do it here.
Silence from around the table. Everybody was thinking the same thing, Peter knew. It comes to this.
All due respect, Michael said. But this is bullshit and you know it.
Peter turned toward him.
So maybe the mirrors slow them down. Fanning is still out there. If what Alicia said is true, the virals we saw last night are just the tip of the spear. He's holding an entire army in reserve.
Let me worry about that.
Don't patronize me. I've been thinking about this for 20 years.
Apgar scowled.
Mr. Fisher, I suggest you stop talking.
Why?
So he can get us all killed?
Michael, I want you to listen to me very carefully.
Peter wasn't angry. He had expected the man to object. What mattered now was making sure everyone stayed on board.
I know your feelings. You've made them very clear. But the situation has evolved.
The timeline has moved up, that's all. We're pissing away our chance sitting around like this. We should be loading buses right now.
Maybe it would have worked before. But we start moving people out of here now, there'll be a riot. This place will come apart. And there's no way we can move 700 people to the Isthmus in daylight. Those buses would be caught in the open. They wouldn't stand a chance.
We don't stand a chance anyway. The Bergensfjord is all we have. Lucius, don't just sit there.
Greer's face was calm.
This isn't our decision. Peter is in charge.
I don't believe what I'm hearing.
Michael looked around the room, then back at Peter. You're just too goddamn obstinate to admit you're beaten.
Fisher, that's enough, Apgar warned. Michael turned toward his sister.
Sarah, you can't be buying this. Think about the girls.
I am thinking about them. I'm thinking about everybody.
I'm with Peter. He's never steered us wrong.
Michael, I need to know you're with us, Peter said. It's that simple. Yes or no?
Okay. No.
Then you're dismissed. The door is that way. Peter wasn't quite sure what was going to happen next. For several seconds, Michael looked him dead in the eye. Then, with an angry sigh, he rose from the table.
Fine. You make it through the night, you let me know.
Lucius, are you coming?
Greer glanced at Peter, eyebrows raised.
It's all right, said Peter. Somebody needs to look after him.
The two men departed. Peter cleared his throat and continued.
The important thing is that we get through tonight. I expect every able-bodied person to man those walls, but we'll need shelters for the rest.
Ford? Chase rose, crossed to Peter's desk, and returned with a rolled tube of paper, which he unfurled on the table and weighed down at the corners.
This is one of the builder's original schematics. Hard boxes were constructed here, he pointed, here and here. All three date to the early days of the city, and none has been used in decades, not since the Easter incursion. I don't imagine they're in very good shape, but with some reinforcement we can use them in a pinch.
How many people can we fit? Peter asked.
Not many. At most a few hundred.
Now over here, he continued, you've got the hospital, which can fit, oh, maybe another 100.
Another smaller box is underneath this building, the old bank vault, full of files and other junk, but basically in good shape. What about basements? There aren't a lot. A few beneath commercial buildings, some of the old apartment complexes, and we can safely assume there are a few in private hands. But the way the city was built, almost everything is on slab or pier. The soil by the river is mostly clay, so no basements at all. That extends from H-Town all the way to the southern wall.
Not good, Peter thought. So far, they had accounted for fewer than 1,000 people.
Now here's the granddaddy. Chase directed everyone's attention to the orphanage, which was marked HB1. When they moved the government from Austin, one of the reasons they chose Kerrville is because of this. While the walls were being constructed, they needed a safe place to overnight the workers and the rest of the government. This end of the city sits on top of a large formation of limestone, and it's full of pockets. The largest one is underneath the orphanage, and it's deep, at least 30 feet below the surface. According to the old records, it was originally used by the sisters as part of the Underground Railroad, a place to hide runaway slaves before the Civil War.
How do we get down there? Apgar asked.
I went and looked this morning. The hatch is under the floorboards in the dining area. There's a flight of wooden stairs, pretty rickety but usable, that leads down to the cave. Dank as a tomb, but it's big. If we pack folks in, it can hold another 500 at least. Chase looked up. Now before anybody asks, I went through the census data last night. It's just an estimate, but here's how things break down. Inside the walls, we have about 1,100 children under the age of 13. Not counting military, the remainder divvies up about pretty evenly in terms of gender. But the population skews old. We've got a lot of people over 60. Some of them will want to fight, but I don't see that they'll be much help, frankly.
So what about the rest? Peter asked.
Of the remainder, we're looking at roughly 1,300 men of fighting age. About the same number of women, maybe slightly less. It's safe to assume some of the women will choose to defend the wall, and there's no reason they shouldn't. The problem is armament. We have weapons for only about 500 civilians. There are probably plenty of guns floating around out there, but there's no way to know how many. We'll just have to wait and see what appears when the time comes. Peter looked at Apgar. What about ammunition? From the general, a frown. Not too good. Last night cost us badly. We've got maybe 20,000 rounds on hand in a mix of calibers, mostly 9mm, 45, and 5.56. Plenty of shot shells, but they're only good for close quarters. For the big guns, we're down to about 10,000 rounds in 50 cal. If the Drax charge that gate, our ammo won't last long. The situation boiled down disconcertingly. Maybe 1,000 defenders on the wall, enough ammunition to last a few minutes at most, hard boxes for 1,000, and 2,000 unarmed civilians with nowhere to hide.
There's got to be some place we can put people, Peter said. Somebody, give me something.
As a matter of fact, Chase said, I've got an idea about that. He rolled out another map, a schematic of the dam. We use the drainage tubes. There are 6, each 100 feet long, so maybe 150 people apiece. The downstream openings are barred. No viral has ever gotten through. The only access on the upstream side is through the waterworks, and there are 3 heavy doors between the tubes and the outside. The beauty of it is, even if the Drax breach the walls, there's no reason they'd think to look there. The people inside would be completely hidden.
It made sense. Ford, I think you just earned your pay for the month.
Gunner.
Apgar, lips pursed, nodded. It's a hell of an idea, actually.
Everybody else?
From the room, a murmur of agreement.
Good, it's settled. Chase, you're in control of the civilian side. We need to start moving people to shelter as soon as possible. No last-minute rushes. Children under 13 to the orphanage, starting with the youngest. Sarah, how many patients do you have in the hospital?
Not many, 20 or so.
We can use the basement hard box for some of the overflow, plus the hard boxes on the west side of town. Gunner, I'll need a security detachment on all of these. Children only, plus mothers with young kids. But no men. If they can walk, they can fight. And if they won't? Martial law is martial law. If they don't take your advice, I'll back your decision. But we don't want to stir things up. Apgar received his meaning with a tight nod. The rest who don't want to fight go in the tubes. I want all sheltered civilians in place by 1800 hours. But let's make this orderly to keep panic to a minimum. Colonel, you oversee assembling the civilian force. Send out a couple of squads to go house to house and put out a call for any additional weaponry. People can keep one rifle or pistol of their own, but any extras go into the armory for redistribution. As of this moment, any working firearm is property of the Texas military. I'll get it done, Henneman said. Peter addressed the group. We don't know how long we'll have to hold them off, people. It might be minutes. It might be hours. It might be all night. They might not attack at all, just wait us out. But if the Drax get in, the orphanage is our fallback position. We protect the children. Is that clear? Silent nods passed around the table. Then we're adjourned. I'll want everybody back here at 1500. Gunner, stay behind a minute. I need a word. They waited as the room emptied. Apgar, elbows resting on the table, eyed Peter over his meshed fingers. So? Peter rose and stepped to the window. The square was quiet, with no one about, everything becalmed in the summer heat. Where was everybody? Probably hiding in their houses, Peter thought, afraid to come out. Fanning will have to be dealt with, he said. This will never end otherwise. This would be the part of the conversation when you tell me you're going to New York. Peter turned around. I'll need a small contingent, say 2 dozen men. We can use the portables as far north as Texarkana, maybe a little farther before we run out of fuel. On foot, we should reach New York by winter. That's suicide. I've done it before. Apgar looked at him pointedly. And you were fucking lucky, if you'll excuse my saying so. Never mind that you're 30 years older and New York is 2,000 miles away. According to Donadio, it's crawling with Drax. I'll take Alicia with me. She knows the territory, and the virals won't attack her. After last night's performance? Be serious. The city won't stand unless we kill him. Sooner or later, that gate will fail. I don't disagree. But taking on Fanning with 2 dozen soldiers doesn't seem like much of a plan to me. What do you suggest? That we hand Amy over? You should know me better than that. On top of which, once we give her to Donadio, we've got nothing. No cards to play. So what then? Well, have you given any more thought to Fisher's boat? Peter was speechless. Don't get me wrong, Apgar continued. I don't trust the man any farther than I can throw him, and I'm glad you tossed his ass out of here. I don't tolerate division in the ranks, and he was way out of line. Also, I have no idea if that thing will even float. I don't believe what I'm hearing. Apgar let a moment pass. Mr. President. Peter. I'm your military advisor. I'm also your friend. I know you, how you think. It served you well. But the situation is different. If it were up to me, I'd say sure. Go down swinging. The gesture might be symbolic, but symbolism matters to old war horses like us. I hate these things, and I always have. But by any measure, this isn't going to end well. Like it or not, you're the last president of the Texas Republic. That pretty much leaves you in charge of the fate of the human race. Maybe Fisher's full of shit. You know the man, so that's your call. But 700 is better than nothing. This place will come apart. There's no way we'll be able to mount a coherent defense. No, probably we won't. Peter turned back to the window. It really was awfully damn quiet out there. He had the unsettled sense of observing the city from some distant future time. Buildings empty and abandoned, dead leaves rolling in the streets, every surface being slowly reclaimed by wind and dust.